Right, so what I'm going to do today is to introduce you to narratological approaches to video games and to show you how we can study narrative artifacts that are meant to be played rather than read or watched. The question is, of course, whether narrative is the right term here. A lot of people would argue that games aren't narratives at all and we should finally stop talking about them in terms of storytelling or even story worlds. But the situation is a little more complex than that, and I'll get to that in a minute. You know that I've got a literary and stylistic and discourse analytical background, and when I look at games, I tend to look at them as texts, which includes their ideological agendas and aesthetic effects. This links in closely with my earlier research on digital literature, particularly fiction, like hypertext, hypermedia, flash fiction, flash with a capital F. And what fascinates me most about this area is not only that it evolves so rapidly and is also so prolific, but it blurs the boundaries between literature, art, and gaming. I'll therefore dedicate the second half of my talk to a close reading or close play of a so-called literary art game, The Path by Tale of Tales. Not sure whether some of you have played it. I'll go into detail about it. And I'll demonstrate how we can analyze complex textual phenomena like this game using a synthetic analytical approach called functional ludonarrativism. Don't be scared, I'll tell you more about this later. So when I first brainstormed the idea of narrative art in relation to computer games, two core ideas came to mind. On the one hand, narrative art in the sense of a craft, a skill, or a set of techniques and conventions used to tell, develop, or evoke stories or story worlds in games. So what I'm going to do first is give you an overview of some general ideas of narrative structures that apply across media, including games. I'll introduce some core elements of games and their study, and I'll look at the specific narrative elements games do use conventionally. From that, I'll move on to some more specific theories of ludic narrativity, and then a rather different approach to the way games communicate meaning, almost the opposite in a Platonic sense, Ian Bogost's procedural rhetoric. In the second part, half, I'll then focus on another important meaning of art, art as a counterforce to mainstream representations, as experimentation and rebellion. I'll talk about situationist détournement as an important underlying theory for this artistic agenda, and I'll explain why it is so suited to a fascinating subgroup of indie games, independent games, so-called art games, which play with, rather than by, the rules of commercial game design. I'll then briefly outline my analytical methodology, and then finally move on to my close reading. Let me start with a few definitions just so you all know what I mean when I talk about narrative here. In her influential book, Narrative Across Media, Marie-Laure Ryan develops a set of semantic criteria that need to be in place for any narrative to come into existence, no matter which medium it occurs in. Novels, movies, drama, painting, architecture, music, or interactive media. She lists three elements. The first one is that a narrative text must create a world and populate it with characters and objects. Now, this condition means that the narrative text is based on propositions asserting the existence of individuals and on propositions ascribing properties to these existence, right? So in the first place, we need some sort of framework, a world, some sort of architecture that is populated. Yeah, so that is important. It doesn't say anything about actions or events yet. This comes in the second bit. So this world needs to undergo changes. Changes of state caused by non-habitual physical events, either accidents or deliberate human actions, and these changes create a temporal dimension. Right? But again, she doesn't say they have to be in a certain order. Just that there are changes. That makes it such a broad definition. And then third, she moves to a more meta level, a superordinate level, which is more about us as receivers and interactors of narratives. A text must allow the reconstruction of an interpretive framework, a network, of goals, plans, causal relations, and psychological motivations around the narrated events. And this gives coherence and intelligibility to the physical events and turns them into a plot. Plot in the broadest sense again. Now, so this is about us making sense of what we see, read, hear, play with, and filling the narrative gaps, you know, that Wolfgang Iser pointed out. So much for narrative. Let me move on to games, or rather ludology first. Ludology is the study of games. So games are complex, representational, textual, and media phenomena that carry multi-layered ideological content. When we study and analyze them, we need to include a wide range of theories and analytical tools that operate at essentially three levels. Games three. Now, the first one is the structural, the system level, where we look at how games represent textually, but also at their text, at their rules, right? So the underlying algorithms, or if we don't understand computer code, how those algorithms evoke or trigger certain actions, interactions, processes in the game. Yeah? So this is the first level. It includes the sort of feedback and achievement reward mechanisms that we get as gamers. The second level is on the human-machine level, about gameplay, yeah? At which point we look at, for instance, ethnographic or psychological approaches, physiopsychological research on how humans and computers interact, but also psychological cognitive ideas, and this will come up again, illusory attitude, that's the sort of attitude we need to adopt to play a game in the first place and also play it successfully. And that could very well involve us having to shoot cute little hobbits if it's part of the game and we want to win, we have to subscribe to that. And another basic and important concept is the magic circle, first outlined by Huizinga, which is sort of an immersive framework, immersive space we are in when we are playing games. And put this little image there. I mean, the membrane is sort of semi-permeable. We can't get out of that magic circle, but only to a certain extent. The gamers amongst you know how difficult it is to tear yourself away sometimes. It's different from reading a book. And then we have the meta zone, which is what I'm doing here, for instance, anything that is about a game or gameplay, about the player, meta discourses and media. And they form the larger framework of gamer culture. It also involves social media, the way people make their own games narratives as well and post them online. Now, a bit of history. We've already heard that it's a very young discipline. In the early years of digital ludology or video games research, and this wasn't so long ago, around the late 90s and the early noughties, most scholars who started studying video games had done their academic training and PhDs in traditional disciplines like literature, drama, and film. And a lot of them tried to apply the theories and methods of their discipline to games, naturally, calling them narratives no matter how abstract their representations. Janet Murray, for instance, whom we have on the left here, claimed that even Tetris has an underlying narrative meaning. She calls it, quote, a perfect enactment of the overtasked lives of Americans in the 1990s, of the constant bombardment of tasks that demand our attention, and that we must somehow fit into our overcrowded schedules and clear up our desks in order to make room for the next onslaught. This and other statements triggered a controversy between narratologists and radical ludologists like Espen Aarseth on the right, and Marco Eskelin, another famous or rather infamous radical ludologist. And this has gone down in the theory books as the ludology-narratology debate. Radical ludologists strongly opposed narratological, or as they call it, narrativist approaches like Janet Murray's. They claim, for instance, that games are probably the most unnarrative of all media because of their multilinearity and their ergodicity, Veridicity is a term coined by Espen Ørset in his 1997 book Cybertext, and it means non-trivial interactive effort. As Eskelin famously puts it in 2001, outside academic theory, people are usually excellent at making distinctions between narrative drama and games. If I throw a ball at you, I don't expect you to drop it and wait until it starts telling stories. Debates like this are typical of the fledgling years of a new discipline, where traditional approaches meet new ones. Luckily, by now it's safe to say that a moderate, more inclusive approach to ludology has evolved from this initial controversy, which acknowledges the validity of narratological approaches as long as they take account of the ludicity of the medium and the fact that games are primarily there to be played rather than watched, read, whatever. Now, and this is the starting point to the rest of my talk. I've just mentioned the word ludicity or gameness. If we unpack this term, it turns out to be quite complex, and the meaning of the word game is difficult to pin down to an all-inclusive definition. Ludwig Wittgenstein, in his philosophical investigations of 1953, was indeed right in saying that games are fuzzy concepts and are probably best understood in terms of family resemblances rather than categorical membership. What we can say, though, is that games tend to share specific components which regulate and structure gameplay. Some of them, the ones you've got listed at the top here, some of them are less compatible with storytelling than others. Some of those at the bottom are more compatible with storytelling. For instance, games offer free gameplay within the constraints of rules. Within these rules, we have to face and overcome challenges which guide our actions. Games are conditional. We can only win or complete a game if we meet the victory and termination conditions. And the main reason why we keep playing are continual rewards and feedback. So games are far more responsive to our actions than, say, novels or films. But then again, games have properties that more readily combine with narrativity. The goals of a game could be seen to correspond with the teleology of a linear story. Now we're moving towards a prefabricated resolution of one or more conflicts. In all this, we're never quite certain what will happen next, although, of course, some reactions of the game system are quite predictable, similar, for instance, to genre fiction. The core mechanic of a game, now that is the logic underlying a game system, which may be a shooter, a racing game, or a quest, can easily adopt a metaphorical or representational framework, for instance, that of an alien invasion, a historical car race, or a Tolkien-esque fantasy adventure. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, games offer a space for possible actions and explorations. And this is probably their most important affinity to narrative, that potential for spatial storytelling. In the past decade, a lot of research has gone into the narrativity of video games. Scholars mostly agree with Marie-Laurent's statement that games aren't narratives, that they aren't narratives, but they have possess narrativity in the sense of elements that are typically found in narratives, characters, causally linked events, and a spatio-temporal setting. So let me summarize very briefly what those narrative elements are that have been highlighted. Now, quite simply, straightforwardly, on a macro level, most narrative games follow the Aristotelian three-act structure of beginning, middle, and end. Some games offer different endings depending on the player's decisions, but mostly they are coherent with the player's specific story arc and gameplay experience. Most narratives follow one of Christopher Booker's seven basic plots of mythology and world literature, most typically overcoming the monster. Think of World of Warcraft, think of Tekken, Dragon Age, Fable. The quest, yeah. Again, Dragon Age, Return to Castle Wolfenstein, Halo, and Rebirth, Pac-Man. And again, I mean, any game that allows for respawning and rebirths, infinite rebirths. So that's the whole cyclicality, isn't it? Similarly, most narrative games feature character types as outlined by Vladimir Propp in his 1928 Morphology of the Folktale, typically the hero, the villain, the dispatcher, the helper, and the prize slash princess. And as I mentioned before, perhaps the most fruitful approach to video game narrativity is to look at their spatial dimensions and affordances, their role as fictional spaces, as environments for navigating and experiencing narrative elements, and as evocative spaces for generating stories. I'll go a bit more into that in a minute. And this approach is followed quite compellingly by Nietzsche and Hewell, and also Henry Jenkins. When we think about temporality in video games, the most important difference to temporality in diegetic narratives like novels is that gameplay always happens in the present, yeah, rather than being told in the past tense. And we tend to distinguish with Marco Eskelinen between user time, which is the time you take to play the game, and that differs radically between gamers. Now, user time and event time, which is the time over which the whole story arc unfolds as a, you know, as a whole. And this is slightly different from Chapman's distinction between story time and discourse time, story time being the time of the full chronological story, and discourse time is the time it takes to tell or read the story. Games come in different points of view. Shooters, typically in the first person, mouse look perspective. And the other games show the avatar from the third person, mostly so from behind at a slightly raised angle. So we're not exactly talking about narrative points of view exactly, but rather our vantage point as players vis-a-vis our avatars. And finally, the most narrative element in a cinematographic sense are cutscenes, which are filmic interludes before, between, and after gameplay. They have different functions, the core ones being reward for successful gameplay, or of course punishment for failure, story progress, you know, they drive the narrative forward and often contain proleptic elements, and rhythm. They happen at regular intervals to give players an opportunity to relax for a minute. Although, I'm not sure how many hardcore gamers are in this room, a lot of people don't appreciate that at all and skip the cutscenes. Right, I said I was going to go into more detail about one theory because it's probably the most comprehensive one I've come across by Henry Jenkins. Like Ryan, he makes it very clear that we need to respect the particularity of this emerging medium, examining games less as stories than as spaces ripe with narrative possibility. And he breaks the narrative properties of games into three core components. The first one is environmental storytelling and evocative spaces. Yeah? Games are designed as environments. It's really interesting when you first start teaching game design students, because they want to tell a story. They have the story in their heads, and it doesn't work like that, because before you can do this, they need to create a space, like, you know, a series of rooms, interconnected rooms, which we can then explore. It's a very different starting point. Yeah? Environments which are full of characters and props to interact with, much like Disney World and other amusement parks. Players explore games spatially, in an episodic way, and this non-linear model is kept coherent by an overarching goal and repetitive mechanic. Games also form part of a larger storytelling ecology. Think of Jenkins' theory of transmedia storytelling. Yeah, The Matrix comes to mind. And games are also evocative spaces with large mnemonic potential, in that they evoke the structures of existing stories and genre traditions of other media. Think of Red Dead Redemption versus the Western genre. Think of the Lego series. Yeah? Lego, Star Wars, Harry Potter, Indiana Jones, it's all there. Hugely successful. And the second one, embedded narratives are narratives which are non-interactive narrative sequences integrated into or surrounding gameplay. I've mentioned cutscenes before, but you could also have backstories, backstory descriptions or dialogues written or voiced over. And then finally, emergent narratives are the sort of narratives that players create themselves by exploring the game world and later telling them in different shapes and forms. They become manifest in oral storytelling, in machinima. Now, machinima is machine cinema, animated films made on the basis of game engines, in participatory media, gamer fora, YouTube, network gamers post their own recounts. And that's really important because they assert their own identity, their power, their status in the gamer community like that. It's really, really important. They spend half their lives making those playthroughs and walkthroughs. Right, so I'd now like to move away slightly from standard commercial blockbuster aesthetic and more into an area where my own research is currently situated, which is indie and specifically art games. These are projects that typically involve very small teams of developers, developers who work to a very limited budget and often without a commercial aim in mind. In fact, I'm mostly interested in those projects that have a distinctly anti-commercial, experimental, artistic, and rebellious agenda. But let me first introduce you the theory that's meant to apply to both camps, although it's probably particularly useful to describe games that have a specific political, educational, and or activist message to tell. It's Ian Bogost's idea of procedural rhetoric, which he uses to account for so-called persuasive games, and those are games that aim to persuade players of a specific attitude towards a political, economic, social, or environmental issue. Procedural rhetoric is the art of persuasion through rule-based representations and interactions rather than the spoken word. So think of games as procedural systems that are programmed in such a way as to evoke and trigger interactions that make us think and act in certain ways. And by acting in those ways and having the right mindset, illusory attitude, we adopt an opinion, or we're likely to buy an opinion, to be persuaded. So two examples here. The first one, I'm afraid I can't play to you because we haven't got Shockwave installed here, but it's a really good one and really short, so you won't spend too much time playing it. It's called September the 12th by Gonzalo Frasca from 2003. Its main theme is the chasing of Middle Eastern terrorists in response to the 9/11 attacks. It's most likely set in Afghanistan, Iraq perhaps. And Frasca himself says the point of the game is that our actions have consequences and that we should try to understand why other people take to arms. The gameplay is quite straightforward. You have to take aim at a terrorist. Terrorists are the ones with sort of the black and white clothing, and the others, the blue ones, are civilians. Now, so you have to aim at the terrorist and shoot them from a helicopter. The problem is that the missile has a few seconds lag, and these people are moving around all the time, and quite unpredictably so. So you're bound to miss, right? It's almost impossible to hit, only by mistake. And what happens, of course, that is that you're more likely to hit a civilian. And you can see a little sort of clock here. It counts a few seconds, and this is the transformative process that the mourners go through when you've hit a civilian, because all the mourners around them will turn into terrorists. So there will be more and more and more terrorists. You can't win this game. It's impossible. A second game, which I should be able to demonstrate to you, is about an economic theme. It's based on Bejeweled. Anybody who doesn't know Bejeweled, now you all know Bejeweled. And Tilt Factor have slapped a representational interface onto the game engine to communicate a specific economic and social message. Right, so familiar interface, right? You have to swap workers. These are all different types of employees, and what you've got to do is put three of the same kind in a row, and you see what happens. Yeah, I mean, if you have those three, they'll be replaced, they'll be eradicated, ergo laid off. And I've just saved $230 million. Isn't that great? I'm damn proud of myself. So this is how it goes. But as you can see, as I scroll over those people, every single one, I mean, no matter how equal they look, has a story at the bottom. And some stories are heartbreaking in that they may have to look after five children at home. Their wife may be sick, right? They really need that job. And you can also see down here, everybody I've laid off is now here on the dole and really angry. So that's one thing that really gets to you, that these are actually individuals and not duals. And there's one type of worker or employee whom you can't lay off. Guess what? The bankers. These are bankers, and whatever I can't eradicate them. It's quite a topical game, nice and sweet and short to play, but you get the meaning or the idea of a persuasive game rhetoric here. Right, so with this slide, I've officially moved into the second half of my talk, which looks at games as narrative art in the sense of an experimental, rebellious counterforce to blockbuster aesthetics and commercial gameplay. I'll now concentrate specifically on art rather than use gaming, so let's start with some theoretical considerations. An important concept for theorizing art games is détournement. Détournement is a situationist term combining the concepts of appropriation and subversion. And it's been translated as diversion. I don't think it's a very good translation. But it basically means taking commodity arts or elements of popular culture and capitalist culture, taking them from out of their original context and reinserting them into a playful mixture. That we could call it some sort of artful plagiarism. But it's playing with established elements, thereby subverting them. Daphne Dragona, in a recent publication, has brought this into the context of the digital sphere and the art games specifically. She says that using play as a practice to transcend rigid forms and to break constraints is a distinctive feature of today's game-based art. Artists working in the field are playing with the rules rather than by the rules. They modify or negate instructions, structures, aesthetics, and norms. Seeing contemporary game worlds as a reflection of the contemporary digital realm. We might therefore think of détournement as a relative of postmodernist deconstruction, but it targets games rather than, say, prestige forms of literature or aleatorics specifically. And it explores linguistically, multimodally, or otherwise, the anti, inter, and meta zones by reflecting on and subverting commercial game conventions. In art, and specifically literary art games, artistic, poetic, and narratological techniques are combined with serious and self-critical game design in order to explore the affordances and limitations of rules, challenges, risks, achievement-drivenness, and other ludic structures. You have a friend, foe, black and white, zero, one, binary idea is subverted. And they try to debunk the hyper-attention and cognitive and behavioral patterns that blockbusters normally evoke. To study narrative video games systematically, we need a methodology that combines ludological and stylistic narratological analysis. To do so, I'm using an approach that was mentioned but not really fleshed out in any detail by Marie-Laurine in her 2006 book, Avatars of Story. She calls this methodology functional ludonarrativism, and it combines ludic and narrative analysis in a way that shows how aspects of gameplay and story work together to shape the player's experience. So, for instance, we need to ask to what extent the player's action contributes to the progression of the plot, and to what extent the plot is imposed upon us through cutscenes, for instance. We have to think about whether the plot is mostly emergent from the player's actions. Now we need to think about types of plot. Now epic, which would be more event-centered, or tragic, which would be more people and conflict-centered. We need to ask what specific character interactions and relationships are possible and what their role is in the game's story arc. A PC-NPC relation stands for player-character, non-player-character relations. But then when we talk about art games, and specifically literary art games, there's more we need to be interested in. We need to ask how game designs make players reflect on gameplay and their own expectations of a game. How those designs experiment with metafictionality and metaludicity, how they employ textual and specifically linguistic devices typically found in literary fiction, poetry and drama, and what kind of illusory attitude they require from players to read rather than just play a game. I'm going to spend the rest of this talk showcasing what I mean by this and how this methodology can be applied. The Path. The Path is a short horror game, yeah, so automatically our horizon of expectation when we approach this as a player is quite clearly geared towards a specific type of gameplay, possibly survival horror or action adventure perhaps. However, not all ludologists and critics agree that it really is a game. I've read a lot of reviews that say no way, it's not a game. Because it goes so many ludic conventions that the player gets the impression that it's got this philosophical message, and this is embedded so strongly in its procedural rhetoric that gameplay is almost less important than introspection, reflection, and self-critical thought. The game features a number of artistic, literary, and fictional devices which bring the interaction with it closer to reading a book, indeed, than playing a first-person shooter or racing game. But let me begin by saying a few words about what the game is about. Now, it's a transmediation of Little Red Riding Hood, and it brings the story into a contemporary setting. Instead of a linear plot, we are offered six different characters as avatars, six sisters aged 9 to 19, whose names are quasi-synonyms of the color red. Now they've got Ginger, Rose, Scarlet, Ruby, Robin, and Carmen. And they're all dressed in various combinations of red and black. They all have age-specific personalities and needs and their own idiosyncratic ways of expressing them. Now, each sister's version of Little Red Riding Hood represents one level or episode of the game and starts in exactly the same way. We leave the big city to pay a visit to Grandmother, surprise, who lives in a dark forest. The only instruction we get at the beginning is to go to Grandmother's house and stay on the path. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? The path unfolding in front of us, however, leads straight to the house of Grandmother, and getting there is not a challenge at all. We just go forward for, say, like 2 minutes maximum. But as soon as we get there, we're told that we failed because we haven't picked up any items, we haven't opened any doors, haven't interacted with anything. Most importantly, though, we haven't met the wolf. Right, so this is maybe a bit disconcerting. Where we learn that it's desirable, if not mandatory, to confront the wolf. And quite clearly, there's no other way of succeeding than to stray from the path into the woods to do all those exciting things, no matter how seriously such behavior breaks the minimalistic rule set of the game. The wolf manifests itself in various physical and abstract forms. For instance, Robin, the youngest, is killed by a literal wolf, an animal, whilst attempting to play with it in the graveyard. Nature lover Rose, whom you have here, drowns in the misty lake because she underestimated its dangers. Ruby, a teenage goth, is tempted by a young man in the playground who offers her drugs or cigarettes and possibly seduces and rapes her. I say possibly because you never see it. You never see what actually happens and how this girl dies. You only get audiovisual clues and very upsetting clues. Specifically in the third part of each level, which is Grandmother's House, where each girl embarks on a very disturbing, traumatic, psychedelic journey through her memories, and it's really, well, it's awful. I'll show you an image of that in a minute. Right, but I told you there were some literary features in the game, besides the fact that it's based on a literary source. The game uses terminology that we know from print fiction and drama to label its structure. It consists of three acts. Act one has a shell menu, which you've just seen, where you choose your avatar. Act two, the woods, forest, which is the main gaming interface. And then this end part, which I just mentioned, Grandmother's House. And Grandmother's House is not only absolutely enormous in its dimensions. I mean, you look at it from outside and you think, oh, well, two bedrooms, perhaps. But you get in there, and it just, you know, it's infinite. It goes on and on and on. And this particular scene is a semi-interactive cutscene viewed from the first person. So you can't see the avatar anymore because you are the avatar. And you can only move forward. Whatever you do on the keyboard, everything you do is only one step forward. You can't turn, you can't go back. You know, inevitably you end up at your final destiny, whatever that is. Yeah? So, I've mentioned acts, and it's the other label that's used is chapter, although that's not necessarily something unique to this game. It's found quite a lot in adventure games more generally. But still, it's different here, I think, end of chapter 2, for instance. It's different here because the game has a horizontal architecture. You can't collect any XP experience points. You can't collect any score points, nothing. It's one experience after another. They're all equivalent. You're not really improving. You're not collecting anything. And that's another thing you need to think about as you play. Right, so I will now try to play through a short clip from the past. It's Ruby's ending, the goth. And it's the typical thing you get when you encounter the wolf, a cutscene starts, a non-interactive cutscene. And, I'll tell you more about it in a minute, but just to give you a feel for the dark tone of the game. I'll stop it, a spoiler warning. But at the end of every one of those cutscenes, there's some image or some variety of grandmother's bed, and the way it's been violated is represented differently every single time. So as she gets there, grandmother's gone, and something's happened to that bed, which is in a way the teleological aim of the game, but you come to realize that it's not, can't be. So, obviously, the game doesn't feature much written or spoken language, as you've seen in the clip just now. However, in every crucial place in the game, the interface shows little snippets of interior monologues. And you've got an example here with Robin, who's the youngest. And those interior monologues show the character's thoughts and indirectly characterize them for the player, of course. The wording matches each figure's stage of cognitive and emotional development and indicates in proleptic and analeptic allusions what will happen and why. Yeah, I mean, Robin here says wolves are just dogs, quite naively. Yeah, werewolves are like people. This adopts a whole different meaning later on as you, you know, game on and you actually realize that she will get killed by a literal wolf. Another literary device is paratextual material surrounding the game. I mentioned the meta level. You know, so whenever you analyze a game, I mean, I personally think you have to look at the wider, the bigger picture. And here it's really interesting because on the website there are life journals for each of those sisters, fictional life journals or blogs, but you can respond to them. So you do this metaleptic jump between the fictional world and your own world, and it becomes even eerier because you just don't know whether they have died or not. You come to think probably they have because the posts stop in early 2009. Right? So another literary, quasi-literary aspect. But moving back from the literary elements to a more sort of a broader metaludic approach, the game uses aesthetic techniques that underscore its subversive and self-reflexive remit. Yeah, and I'm going to show you three aspects of that: metaludic mechanics, illusory agency, and allusive fallacy, three derivations from ludus, the game. So it won't be very long, I promise. Metaludic mechanics describes elements of game design that make us reflect critically on gameplay and our illusory attitude. Yeah? The path is quite clearly a meta game because it makes us reflect on our expectations, sort of expectations set by commercial blockbusters with regards to speed, action, and complexity. This game is a slow game. This is actually a genre label, slow games, within the art game sector. We can run over short distances, but if we sort of press the run button too long, either the system will crash or the view will get blurry, so it's not really a good experience, and we end up walking rather than running for sometimes hours if we don't find anything. So there has to be some point to this endless wandering and wandering, now the pun is deliberate, because it's core for reflecting and interpreting. The game can only be successfully played if we break the only rule it has, to go to grandma's house without leaving the path. And the game manual emphasizes this in its pretext. It says, there's one rule in the game, and it needs to be broken. There is one goal, and when you attain it, you die. The goal is, of course, to meet the wolf, although this results in trauma and death inevitably. In other words, the narrative meaning of the game, which is that traumatic events and experiences are inevitable and instructive in adolescent maturation, is manifested through the mechanics of finding and interacting with the wolf for success, if you can call it interaction. Although we're essentially dealing with a monster here, in different shapes, the path doesn't let us fight or kill it, which is what we would expect, and that's not the point. Yeah, and again, this makes it not only a meta game, but indeed an anti-game. And so we can't win this game, it doesn't want to be won. More important is the reflection and the learning process it aims to evoke in players. Finally, we may also say that the game alludes to a specific ludological theory by Roger Calois, which distinguishes between paideia, sort of naive, children's play, innocent, and ludus, which is the sort of serious, rule-based, structured gameplay we're more familiar with from adulthood. And this move is signified here. The second method or tool is illusory agency, another deceptive aspect. It refers to the illusion that the player has near infinite possibilities and personal choices, but, in fact, players are guided along rigid lines through a relatively linear narrative. Now, this seemingly endless mise-en-scène unfolding before us in Act 2 requires a large degree of agency, strategic thinking, although it's rather helpless strategic thinking, I have to say, trial and error, exploring. You know, there isn't a prefabricated narrative path to follow, except for the suggestive age sequence, perhaps. But then we can play them in any order. Yeah, so the endless woodlands seem to suggest a sandbox game, and they do, obviously, you know, the character isn't led along a certain predetermined trajectory, but the sense of agency evoked by this idea is reduced to a minimum once we realize that it's not about collecting objects, it's really about meeting our fatal destiny. And then, as I indicated before, those interactions are really interactive. They aren't. Now, as soon as we touch on something that can be interacted with, a cutscene stops, and we end up sitting there watching what's going on. Again, it's not really what we expect. The third item is elusive fallacy, which means deliberately misleading the player, typically through deceptive semiotic clues. So once diverged from the path, we find ourselves in an impermeably dense forest, little specks of light, dust in the air, and on the ground, and the sort of scattered sun rays seem to suggest that maybe we have to go in some kind of direction here, but then you see this mist in the distance, and well, there's no, I mean, no sense of deep space here at this level, although we know that there must be something further on. So this is really, well, misleading. And then we get this trail. Yeah, this is actually the trail the character has, the avatar has taken so far. This is where we are now. This is where we've come from. But it doesn't help, does it? Because it's taken out of context. So what's the point? This is only when we first play the game. Upon the second and third playthrough, and any further ones, we get a lot more clues, interestingly, in the margins. Iconic clues are pointing towards the lake or the field of flowers, of course the wolf here. And there's some more ambiguous, non-iconic trolls here. And if we haven't read the manual, there's no way of finding out what they mean and how they can point us maybe in the right or wrong direction. So another way of confusing us. And third example I want to show you, which I found most upsetting, was the superimposed close-ups, which you get when you try to interact with any item that isn't meant for you, for this particular character, but for another one. But if you don't know that, you're bound to interpret this superimposed image as some sort of foreboding. What will happen to Carmen, to the older one in this goal? What has happened to her? And was I supposed to find out? Am I supposed to find out? Will I ever? Ooh, right? So, you know, the whole eerie atmosphere is further augmented. Right. To conclude, I hope I've demonstrated how we can conceptualize games as narrative art, particularly in relation to literary gaming, and how we can bring together ludological, narratological, and textual analysis to do justice to their complex aesthetics. We've seen how the path thematizes and subverts the ludic conventions of commercial blockbuster games. It can't and doesn't want to be won. Instead, we see ourselves repeatedly embarking on the eternal quest for the Holy Grail as we follow the Six Sisters' adolescent trajectory from Paideia to Ludus in the path, only to find that the closure promised by the quest genre is but the beginning of a new chapter in the game. We come to realize that our main target is to employ our philosophical and hermeneutic capacities to learn how to die, as Montaigne puts it so aptly in his eponymous essay. And our gameplay becomes a rite of passage in the art of 21st century Epicureanism.